Hi, Bruno. I'm very happy to welcome you to the Solary report. As you know, I'm in charge of a series about what's going on in Europe. It's called Via Europa. And at the beginning of the year with Catherine, we did a short list of the topics we wanted to cover this year. And among the top first three, there was the energy issue in Europe. And that was before the Ukraine war. And well, the first name that came up in my mind when I wonder who I should ask for his knowledge and enlightenment about the topic was you, Bruno Combi. So to introduce you to our members, you're a specialist in energy and nuclear power. You're from the École Polytechnique in France, which is a very famous engineer school. And you have years of experience and work on this topic. I know that you love to write about other issues that covers health and other very interesting topics. But the one topic we wanted to discuss with you, and we want your information and your analysis about, it's what's going on the energy field, market consumption in Europe, and where do you think our elite, the people who govern the system, are going to lead us to? So I'll let you decide which information you'd like to share with us about the energy in Europe.
Yes, thank you, Vanessa. Hello to all our viewers. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. As an introduction, thank you for the presentation, by the way. As an introduction, I would just like to remind that I grew up in the field of energy. My father was an oil exploration geologist. His first job was to find the oil as a geologist. He was hired initially in 1959 by the Société Nationale des Pétroles d'Aquitaine, SNPA at the time. In English, this would be a national company for the production of oil in Aquitaine, which is the southern region of France. At the time, France was producing most of its oil. Of course, this did not last very long with the roaring 70s. And we had to go, and the second job for my father was to go to Gabon in Africa to search for oil down there. That's the reason my first 3 years were in the African jungle in Gabon. Then we moved to the United States because when you find oil in one country, you rapidly will pump the oil out and you need to search for it elsewhere. So we went to the United States for a couple of years, then 7 years in Canada. Then my father worked for the Middle East for quite a while and ended his career negotiating for the gas in Siberia with the Russians. So that was my context when I grew up as a kid. And so I learned very young that we were living in the world of oil at the time. It wasn't the how the story started. Initially, the main energy was wood for the heat and cooking. Then it became coal with the Industrial Revolution in the mid-19th century. And then it became the world of oil, the world in which you, Vanessa, or myself were born. But at the time, I remember in Alberta when we went hunting with my father, I was 8 years old. And he was working as a geologist for Canada. And the gas was considered almost useless then. It wasn't used because there were no pipelines at the time, and gas is difficult to transport. So I was asking my father, how come we don't use this energy to heat up the homes and the cities? And his answer was, it will happen in the future, but we don't have the pipelines for the moment. By the time we construct those pipelines and the exploitation system, then it will be the case. So you will see that world. That's the world we're living in right now, still heavily dependent on oil, especially for transport. But the gas infrastructures have been developed quite a bit, so it's the world of oil and gas. And then the next question was, what will be the energy in the future? When I was 8 years old again, to my father. And his deep answer was, today we're in the world of oil and gas, but tomorrow it will be the world of nuclear energy. It was the dawn of nuclear energy at the time. In the meanwhile, nuclear energy has developed quite a bit. It's become industrial, feasible. We have the feedback, the know-how, but it was strongly put back by the green groups, which opposed nuclear energy quite a bit. So my father's prediction that the future of the world will be nuclear energy is still true, but it was somewhat halted for a couple of decades by the green groups. The crisis we are living today will probably be what changes everything in that matter. In the recent decades, being pro-nuclear had become something a little sort of bad. The waste, nuclear waste, risk of accidents, and so on. But the world first had a sort of wake-up call in 1973 with the big oil shock. This shock was very brutal, especially for Europe and especially in France. The reason is that what we said at the time, we have no oil, no coal, or almost none, and no gas, or almost none. It was all pumped out. And so no choice. So France then turned massively to nuclear energy as the energy of the future. It was not the only decision that France took in 1973 and 1974. There was also energy efficiency, saving energy, and also developing renewable energies already. So the three solutions to the big crisis then: renewables, energy savings, and nuclear energy. One was a total failure. It was renewable energy. Didn't get us very far. One was a half success. It was saving energy. We called it la chasse au gaspille, how not to waste. And this was quite a success. There was the first regulations for buildings to lower the energy need for oil. At the time, most buildings were then heated with oil. And the nuclear program was, of course, a great success that the entire world has watched, seen, and is somewhat imitating. Now we have a new crisis, which is probably even bigger by the intensity and the consequences for the world as a whole, but especially for Europe, which is at the center of the war, and especially for France to some extent. But because we did have some diversification with nuclear energy, we're not as fragile as Germany, who's been the most powerful country in Europe in the last years. Germany, of course, chose not to develop nuclear energy, and that was a big mistake. And now, for this reason, they will suffer more than France. And France will probably take the leadership of Europe again because of this. Now, the whole story of energy is, of course, very central and important for Europe for several reasons. First, because, as I mentioned, for France, we don't have much resources. In the United States, there's some oil, there's some coal, there's some gas, there's a lot of gas in Canada. There's also quite a bit of oil in Mexico or Venezuela. So the US still have fairly large resources of oil and gas. Europe has very little. Of course, Norway has some oil in the north, but countries like France, Belgium, Italy, Germany have very little oil and gas, Spain. So the main European countries have no resources. There's still some coal, mostly in the east of Europe, Poland, Germany, but not in France, not in Western Europe. So for this reason, Europe is very much at risk in the current situation because we don't have much resources. The three possible answers to this crisis are pretty much the same as in 1973. When the price of oil and energy had abruptly increased. So there's quite a few lessons we can take from the first oil shock in 1973 to face the situation where we are today. Basically, we have the same three solutions. And if I had to bet, I would put my my belief in the fact that the three solutions will give exactly the same results at the same time. Nuclear energy is a fantastic solution, and it can solve the problem. Energy saving can contribute, but we still, if we want to live in a modern world with a modern way of life, we still need large amounts of energy. So it's a sort of half solution. And renewable energy, which did not work the first time, will also not work today for the exact same reasons. These energies, solar and wind, they are dilute. So there's a little bit everywhere, but a lot of it nowhere. And so they have to be concentrated using huge surfaces of land just to produce small amounts of energy. So that's a sort of fundamental difficulty that you cannot turn around. And then the second difficulty, which is maybe even worse, is the intermittency, is that the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So this is a physical difficulty that is fundamental to how the universe works, and it will not change even after a few years, a few decades, even if we pray very hard, even if we, there's nothing that will change the law of physics. So the intermittency of renewables is really the worst part. With the modern batteries, like the Tesla batteries, for example, that we have today, power walls, power packs, we can store small amounts of energy. Like, for example, the solar production on the roof of a house, you can store it when it's produced during the day for being consumed at night. So that is possible. The problem is that at times you can have several weeks or a month without sun or with very little sun. And especially in winter, when you have the greatest need for energy to heat the homes in Europe. So there's no way the sun can provide such large amounts of energy that we can store it for a month. The batteries are not enough. If you install a power wall, it costs, like in France, it's about 10 to 15,000 euros. So it's cheap enough that a rich family can afford it, but not cheap enough that you can afford 10. And so it will help, but it will not account for winter and storing the solar production of summer for being used during the winter. That doesn't fit the need. And it's just pretty much the same thing for the wind, where you can have several weeks without much wind. For example, if there's an anticyclone over the whole of Europe, it can last for weeks and there's no wind then. And that's in winter, the moment where it's the coldest weather. So these intermittent and dilute energies will not solve the problem, just as they haven't solved it in 1973. It will also not solve the problem right now. It can help to a very small extent, but it's pretty marginal. It's not the big part of the solution.
Okay, so now if you're saying that, if my numbers are right, I mean, Europe is importing more than 60% of its energy on fossil resources. France is better off because we have 50% at least from the nuclear power. If I understand you correctly, and if I look at what the European Union is doing, do you have the feeling that they're doing what's needed for Europe to thrive and to be able to be less energy dependent? Like, for instance, if Germany is the weakest link here, all the more since Germany is a heavy industrial country compared to the Latin countries or even Central European countries. I'm sorry, I'm having a spam call, as we call it. So do you have the feeling that the European policies are in line with the energy need of Europe? I mean, what we're going to see with the Ukrainian war and what we need as resources. Do you think that the European Union is doing what's necessary for Germany, France, and the whole Union to be independent or more self-independent on energy issues?
To say the truth, I think Europe is in a big problem here. There's two solutions. Either Russia maintains the supply of oil and gas to Europe, or it doesn't. If it maintains the supply, then maybe we'll have enough time to adapt. If it cuts the supply, which has been a risk for a long time, I have been in my lectures and conferences around the world calling the attention of world leaders and engineers and people around the world on this problem. But most governments have preferred to follow the Greenpeace views that we will decarbonize with intermittent energies, which simply doesn't work. But if Putin cuts the supply of oil and gas for Europe, Europe is in a really big problem. And the reason is that we have to do a major energy transition. So this is not a new subject. We've been talking about it ever since the first oil shock again. So remember 1973? That was almost 50 years ago, half a century. What have we done? Well, in the beginning, we've acted like developing the French nuclear program in France or developing more efficient systems, energy systems. But at the same time, there was such a economical development that the energy need has greatly increased in the meanwhile. The population has also increased quite a bit. And so we still need very large amounts of energy. And this energy, for the moment, as you just reminded us, is mostly imported from foreign countries, mostly the Middle East and Russia for Europe. So Russia is a big provider. It provides 40% of the natural gas for Europe. So it's a really big provider. This gas is used both for the industry and also to a large proportion for heating the buildings. So the main problem is not right now, because we have reserves, gas reserves in stock, which will be okay for the summer where we don't need a lot of gas because there's very, very little heating in the buildings, of course. And even if we don't have it, it's not a tragedy. The problem will come in the autumn. It means in October, November 2022. Because if the gas stocks are not full and ready for the winter, and Putin cuts the gas at that moment, we're really in a big trouble then. And so the difficulty is that an energy transition, whatever the transition may be, takes time, takes large amounts of time. If you look at the example of France, who did the transition with its nuclear program, the program started as a crash program, top national priority in 1973, 1974. This program was terminated in 1999, when the last nuclear power plant in France of the big national program was put online. So that was Civaux number 2, and it was put online in January 1999. So that's a quarter of a century later, 25 years later. So if you want to put it short, it takes at least 20 years to change the energy infrastructures of a big country like France or Germany, and even more if you start reasoning at the scale of a continent like Europe as a whole. You don't build factories in just a click of a finger. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes investment, it takes engineers. You have to train the engineers, you have to build up the systems. It's not instantly. So there are things that you can do rapidly, like use a little less gas. If you get the temperature down in the homes for each degree, you make a 7% saving on the amount of gas you need to heat the home. So if you get it down by 3 degrees, you might save, let's say, 20%. So that's good, but it means you have the same comfort. You need to have control over the people. Many people perhaps won't do it, even if they're asked to do it. You can't force them to do it. And it will only solve 10 or 20% of the problem. And now we really have a big problem. It's 40% will be missing. And let's hope that the remaining 60% of the suppliers will continue to provide, because the current crisis is a world crisis. It's not only about Europe. So the other providers will also be in great demand from other parts of the world, like China, who requires a lot of energy, like Africa, who is developing. So it's not 100% certain that if we turn to other suppliers, which is, of course, the solution that everybody presents as what we should be doing, Okay, but the other suppliers also have other clients that they need to serve. So it's we are facing a difficult situation. The main risk is probably because that's where the main energy consumption that is put at risk is located. That's where we don't have a lot of resources. And that's where most of the economic development is located, like financial needs, industrial needs, and so on. China is also a great risk, which is probably an explanation of why there is a problem. And basically, if we ask the question, how come this situation is happening right now? Why didn't it come before, or why won't it be coming later? There's a very good reason to this, and it's all about, as usual, about geostrategy, energy geostrategy. Energy is basically the core of everything. It keeps your home warm, but it also feeds you, it runs your industry, it powers the car and the transportation system, it powers the communication system, it powers the computers, the intelligence, the prosperity. It's the main driver of everything in a modern economy. So once you understand this, most of what happens about international geostrategy, the main subject is always energy. So for example, if you look at main reasons for war, it's often about energy. And the main reasons for prosperity when you do things right is also about energy. For example, Europe, which has been powerful for the past half century, and Europe was built around the in energy community. In the beginning, it was called the CECA, Communauté Européenne du Charbon et de l'Acier. In English, it's the European Community for Coal and Steel. This was in 1951, 1952. So that is what got Europe together in the first place. It was sharing knowledge, energy infrastructures, building partnerships for energy, and at the time, coal was a very important energy, and the production of steel was a very important industry for the reconstruction of Europe after World War II, of course. So Europe sort of structured itself after World War II around this energy, CECA. And then it was prolonged in 1957 with the Euratom Treaty, when it appeared that nuclear energy could play an important role. The Euratom Treaty was the same thing with the same countries, France, Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Italy. And so this was the core of Europe, and it was the first European community. And it, so it all structured around first coal, steel, and then nuclear energy. So we can see that it's all around the question of energy. And now we have a big crisis, which will hopefully, and I hope not, but which may sort of tear apart Europe, because different countries like France and Germany have been doing different choices, especially about what is the main part of the solution for the future, nuclear power. And so France did the right choice, Germany did the wrong choice, and will suffer more in this coming crisis. The thing is, in the first wake-up call in 1974, the price of oil and gas abruptly increased. But if you paid for it, you came with millions of dollars, you could still have it, just pay more. The problem with the crisis today, and I've been announcing this for years, is that in the new crisis, the problem is not just about price, it's about supply. It's about having the energy, because at some point there will not be enough for everybody. It means that entire parts of the world and or parts of Europe will be simply deprived from energy, oil, and gas.
Well, one of the suppositions that Catherine discussed during one of her series is that it's like what's happening with Russia. It's also a way to reallocate the supply of gas and oil to China. Yep. That was one of the supposition was that it was like a power in place wanted to reallocate the resources. But one thing that I could understand, and I can't understand if it's the plan, Germany is left out, unless there's a supply from the US and gas and oil, et cetera, which will be very expensive, I guess. And the second thing that I don't understand, it's if France did the right choice in going for nuclear powers, we know that Macron, the president in place, and Hollande before have decreased the importance of nuclear power, have shut down a nuclear plant, Fessenheim, and Alstom, which was a big French company, has been sold out to the Americans, even though a piece of it will come back to France. And so it's very difficult to see what kind of strategy there is, unless there's a power grab in Europe by controlling the supply of electricity, energy, et cetera, and reallocation of resources to China and to the Asian countries.
Well, that's exactly the problem, Vanessa, is that there is no strategy. That's the problem. Energy, during in the 70s and 80s, you had to build the infrastructures, you had to reconstruct, rebuild the countries. So everybody was working to do more and better. And it was all about building. And then things became sort of easy. Energy was just flowing, the economy was thriving, everybody was getting richer and richer. So everybody was pretty much happy. And then people lost the view of the strategy. We just forgot to have a strategy. And politicians in Europe started thinking that the only important thing was getting reelected. It wasn't about building or serving the country anymore. And so wrong choices have been made by ideology. So because we were rich enough, we started developing ideologies like the green ideology and forgetting about the essentials, which is the energy supply. And so our politicians have been blinded by their own re-election, by their own ideologies, by their own program, and they forgot about what is so important, and that our economy is the center of everything, and that energy is the center of our economy. So they considered that electricity is taken for granted, and the oil supply is taken for granted, and you don't need to bother about these things. That costs a lot of money, it takes time. My next re-election is the most important thing on the planet. And this is a part of the explanation of the problem Europe is sitting in today. Now, to come back to what you were saying about Russia turning to China, that is probably the worst scenario that could happen for Europe. And it is a real risk. But I think the real explanation is at an even other level. What has changed and explains the current situation is the position of the United States, which is the main country in the world, the first world power. And until a few years ago, the United States was a net importer of energy. It was importing gas, mostly from Canada, and it was importing oil, mostly from the Middle East. But because of the shale oil and shale gas coming into production, the United States, since a couple of years, has become a net exporter of energy again. Therefore, until a few years ago, the world was divided between the West and the East, Russia and the United States, the communists and the modern economies. But since a few years ago, what has completely changed is that there is now a common interest. It's quite paradoxical, but there's a common interest between Russia and the United States to have a very high cost on gas and oil, which was not the case before. So the two super world powers, military world powers, now share an interest, which is that it's okay if oil is very expensive, and it's okay if gas is very expensive, because it just brings even more money coming into the country. Now, before that, they were opposed. So the war for energy in the Middle East, for example, which has been the big friction spot on the planet, was a proxy war between the United States, the Russians, and these two big blocs. And the interest of the Americans was to protect Saudi Arabia to make sure the oil stays cheap enough to fuel the American economy. And also the European friends, because Europe is like an ally for the United States against Russia. So there was common interest between the United States and Europe against the Russians. And China pretty much was inexistent at the time on the international scale. This has completely changed, but most people have not noticed or understood yet. Since the production of shale gas and shale oil and shale gas has brought this common interest of having a high price of energy on oil and gas, which is now shared between the Russians and the Americans. Now, of course, this completely changes the world geostrategy. Because the main focus, I think, is not on Europe, in fact. The main concern is for the US to try to slow down the development of China in order for the US to remain the number one superpower in the world. And in order to do this, China is a huge energy importer. It has not much domestic production, except for the coal. But it does not have much gas, and it does not have much oil. So it is of a geostrategical interest, an important point for the United States to get the price of energy up in order to improve the economical situation for the U.S. and at the same time keep the pressure on the Chinese development. And so this is what pretty much creates behind the scenes the current energy situation in Europe, which is at the center of major changes occurring in the world right now. Of course, then you have all the story of the Nord Stream gas pipeline, which provides much of the gas for Europe. Of course, this is also a German choice, which was pretty much imposed on Europe by Germany. They wanted a direct access to natural gas from Russia. Nord Stream 1 and then Nord Stream 2 because the capacity was not enough. And in order to avoid being too dependent on Russia and the other gas pipelines coming from the southern routes. And so this was imposed to Europe by Germany, and it was a mistake. The right answer was develop nuclear program massively for Europe. But because the Germans were dominant on Europe, they sort of slowed down even the French nuclear program, as you mentioned.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I got a feeling too that the reason why Germany will slow down nuclear power was also a way to make France weak.
Exactly. It makes France weaker. It makes Germany stronger inside Europe. But it also, the main problem is that the main enemy for Germany is not France. We're allies, we're neighbors. We're not trying to hit each other on the head. And that was the spirit after World War II, is to unite everybody and work together in the same direction. We're on the same continent, and it's always better when you get along with your neighbor rather than start fights. And that was the mistake from Germany. They considered France as a rival, because we had nuclear power and that could get us better than the situation they were. So they tried to work around this by continuing to emit large amounts of carbon into the atmosphere, burning their coal. And then when it's now the new trend is that you should get coal a little lower. And so they made agreements with Russia and the Nord Stream pipelines. And this was a major mistake in my view, because it makes it, not only Germany, but the whole of Europe, highly dependent on Russia. Now we can see the result of that strategy, which is completely wrong. And so this was all signed and put in place by Germany. So the German example was the wrong example. I've always been saying that. But if what we see today, it was really a lot wronger than we've even ever imagined. And so Nord Stream 2 is not is being halted. Now that is also under pressure, for strong pressure from the United States. And so I think it's also a mistake from the United States. Because, of course, it's not good to be dependent on the Russians. But we will be missing about 100, if Putin cuts the gas, we'll be missing about 150 to 180 million cubic meters of gas per year. And, of course, we've been negotiating with the United States recently. And the United States has agreed to help Europe and to the extent of 15 million cubic meters of gas per year. So it solves a little less than 10% of the problem. So US will provide in the form of liquefied natural gas, 10% of what Europe.
Sorry.
Well, this will, but it will not solve the problem again. Yeah. We're still facing a major energy shortage, a major shock on the prices. Also, because the gas imported through the pipelines from Russia is not in liquefied form. It's gas under pressure, but it's gas. So it requires a lot less energy to transport than liquefying the gas, which makes it a lot more expensive and a lot more complicated to load it on the ships. You need the export terminals on one side and the import terminals for gasification and degasification, liquefaction and deliquefaction on the other side. And so for the moment, Europe simply doesn't have the boats to transport the liquefied gas, neither does the US. We don't have the ports in the US to export enough gas, and we don't have the ports in Europe to import enough gas. So it just doesn't fit the need. And this, again, building a major port and a major liquefaction factory, it takes years and years and years again. And so the infrastructure is not in place. So whatever happens, if it happens rapidly, Europe is in a big mess. That's the situation.
And to make a link, you know that I'm a real estate agent, and to make a short link, I've noticed in many buildings and commons, multifamily buildings, now the Colin electric appliances, Collins, and now the gas appliances too, the Collins, they're made to, normally they're private, they belong to their common share, they're owned by the owners of each apartment, and now they're being sold to GRDF and Enedis, the companies that are in charge of the maintenance of the electrical appliances. So it basically means that it's no longer a private property. You have these smart meters being put in place, and you have a new regulation on properties that with different categories of energy efficiency. And if you're like E, F, G, sooner or later, you won't be able to rent them out unless you do some work for insulation or replacement of windows. And sometimes you can't do anything. You won't be able to change the category, which basically means, like, for instance, in Barrie, 80% of the apartments might not be rentable anymore. So it's like, and if you mix that with the price of electricity and gas that's going higher up, you will have people who won't be able to pay their bills, won't be able to find a rentable apartment because the market will be squeezed. And it's like I have my feelings that we're going through a control system that will be put in place through the energy and heating system. What do you think?
Yes. Absolutely. Everything is about energy. And when you control energy, you control the people. You control the activity, the economy of a country. So the energy crisis which we are facing is not just an energy crisis. It will have consequences on all the other fields. And of course, it also has consequences on the property, on the housing, on the economy, on the industry, and everything gets more complicated. And we can see that in all these sectors, it's also linked to liberty and control over the people, as you mentioned. During World War II, of course, there's conscription. Young men have to go to war. Women have to go to the factories to build the ammunition. And after World War II, there was the 1960s. It was all about freedom and liberty and being independent, and everybody could, build his own home and be happy and consume more consumer goods and go on vacation, work less. And of course, what's happening today is the exact opposite. Our liberties are taken away from us. We have to work more for less money. Then we have travel rules, which we can't travel anymore as we want to. And if we don't have the energy, we can see now that the fuel jet for airplanes, the price is going up. So people will not be able to travel anymore. As you mentioned, the heating homes becomes a problem. Then paying your rent becomes a problem, or buying your home, because the real estate is also very high. And the cost for young people to buy today is very high. And so controlling the energy and provoking these crises means that you're putting control and the population is becoming closer to being slaves, like in a world economy, that people are imposed a lot of things, that you're not able to choose what you're doing, what's your activity. If you have any money, it might be stolen from you through the form of taxes, very high taxes, confiscations, or obligations of all sorts. And so, yes, you are right, Vanessa. It's not just about energy. It's also all about liberty, freedom, and happiness. And that's probably the saddest part of the story, of course. But if we can also be optimistic, I'm basically an optimistic. I also created the optimistic movement. And as you mentioned in the beginning, a lot of my work is about promoting natural health and better health for the people. And so there's lots of things we can do at all of these levels. But if the energy choices are not made right by our governing politicians, then it just puts the whole thing down. And unfortunately, wrong choices have been made, which brings us in a difficult situation. It's not too late to act better right now, as fast as we can. And basically, the biggest part of the solution is to transition as fast as possible to the big, massive nuclear program for the future. That's the main part of the solution. Of course, at an individual level, you can also buy a stove and heat your home with wood, like many people did several decades ago. But if everybody does that, you can imagine the air pollution in the Paris area going back up again. And it's like going back 50 years back. Now, the future is a clean, massively abundant, and cheap power for all the people. And there's only one solution for that that really works. It's nuclear energy. Unfortunately, like every other solution, it takes two decades to build. So France is the example we have to follow. Turning to more electric cars is also a part of the solution. But Germany should start to open its eyes and imitate France instead of trying to give lessons to the whole of Europe all the time.
Well, I think Germany is split, and there's an elite that's against France and another one that is very similar to us. And the whole play is trying to divide France and German, French and German people and having them fight each other, which is an old story. Bruno, yeah. Look, it was very interesting talking to you. I think Catherine will invite you over and maybe you will have a conversation directly with each other. She might have lots of questions for you. To finish off and just to give you an anecdote, I've been following a special training on woods and how we cut woods, trees, how to assess the volume of wood you need to to consume for a fireplace at home, because my mom has a property and some trees are 60 years old. So I think it was interesting right now to see how we can use this wood for winter times. Actually, right now in Toulouse, in the south of France, it's snowing. And when the 1st of April, it's not an April Fool's joke, it's snowing. So we better take care, we better organize ourselves on the individual base at first, and then push our elites and our politicians for them to take real decision. Thank you very much, Bruno. I'm so happy I found the resource and a knowledgeable man to answer my call and my questions about energy in Europe. Thank you, Bruno, and I hope you come back. Bye.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.